You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're happy to be broadcasting today from the WPR studios in Milwaukee. And coming up, we'll do a little time traveling and visit Milwaukee in the 1930s.
First, your typical summer beach reads are light, fairly easy, usually fiction. But Central Time listeners, we know you love learning. So we're bringing our science expert on now to talk about some smart, science-y books you could still relax with on your summer vacation.
And we want your suggestions, too, at 800-486-8655. Do you have a favorite science book to share? Do you need some recommendations? And what is the best science book that you've ever read? You can call in now at 800-486-8655 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Gemma Tarlak is in the studio with us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to talk to you in person.
Hello, it's great to be here in person. It's exciting.
Well, before we get to specific recommendations, what to you makes a really good science read?
Oh, for the summer, now we're talking, right?
Sure, anytime, but especially the summer.
Well, you know, to me, science has to be fun. You know, it has to be fun and it has to be enjoyable and entertaining. Yes, it's serious. You want to learn stuff as well, but there has to be a fun element. So I really look for a science summer read that is enjoyable. It's something that if you put the book down to put on some more sunblock or whatever, you turn to the person next to you and you're like, can you believe this? And this, you know, you want to share what you're learning.
And you've been reviewing some science reads for Discover Magazine. What's been fitting that particular bill recently as you get ready to look into summer? We're not quite there yet, but you're already thinking summer reads.
Well, there are a bunch. And you know, with our production schedule, I was actually reading summer reads back in January and February. So really, that's how it works.
But you're still on the beach with the sunscreen because you're a method
yes.
writer.
In my parka. And I have to say there are a couple clear favorites for me. And one of them is actually already out. It's called Death on Earth, and it's by British zoologist Jules Howard. It is probably the funniest book you'll read about the science of death ever. He just has a really witty, self-deprecating, fun tone, and you're learning a ton. You're getting really deep into defining life, defining death, but you're really enjoying it. It's just like a really well done book. And I also loved his earlier book, Sex on Earth. He's got kind of a theme going, all the big things, yeah.
And you interviewed the author of Death on Earth and for your new blog on the Discover Magazine website. As I understand it, part of the problem in understanding death scientifically is trying to figure out what life means.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's so many different ways of defining life. And, you know, you might think, well, respiration. One of the ways to define life is respiration. But technically, your refrigerator breathes. In a way. And so, you know, there are all these things. And then you look at something like a tardigrade. Tardigrade are these microscopic animals. They're also called, favorite thing ever, moss piglets. Okay, so they're these microscopic little animals. They live all over. You can find them in outer space. And they can go dormant and just be essentially dead for years. And then wake up again and be like, fine, floating around. So how do you really define what life is? That's an intriguing question. And he kind of gets at a couple different ways of looking at it.
I loved where you asked him, this is in your blog, but you asked him, you know, what made him sort of uncomfortable as he did this. And his answers were pretty interesting, especially, you know, what it was like to hang out with people who refused to accept that we might die someday.
Right, yeah. He has this wonderful, wonderful chapter on going to one of those anti-aging conferences, but I don't mean anti-aging just like putting on a little skin cream to get rid of the wrinkles. I mean people who are, you know, injecting other people's plasma and stuff just to prolong their life. And he's just very uncomfortable because these people are just almost a different species to him. And he actually gets physically sick at the conference, and it's kind of hysterical because he is very self-deprecating, and you're feeling it, you know, while he's there, but you're also laughing at him a little bit, gotta say.
Well, the subtitle of Death on Earth is Adventures in Evolution and Mortality. So is the idea that there's an evolutionary benefit to dying? Seems kind of that cross purposes in some ways.
Well, when you think about it, you know, we talk always about survival of the fittest, but it's really not survival of the individual necessarily. It's really survival of the species of the fittest. So if you think about it, if nothing ever died, we would run out of resources very quickly. And also, you know, there are a lot of plants, a lot of microorganisms that need something to die in order to have a food resource.
And so that's one of your favorites, and an interview with the author is up on the blog. And there was another that you talked about, made me think twice as someone who's sort of simultaneously fascinated by and terrified by snakes, one looking at rattlesnakes.
Yeah, Ted Levin, he's a zoologist, I believe out of New England. He wrote a book called America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. And I just love this book because I like snakes. They're nothing to be afraid of. Trust me, it's okay. It's going to be okay. And he just looks at really all different aspects of it. And, you know, the rattlesnake in America, it's not just a snake. It is like the pinnacle of evolution of snakes in a lot of different ways. And he gets into the physiology, he gets into the evolution, and then he gets into the whole, you know, in certain aspects, it's revered. It's kind of like this, oh, this iconic, incredible animal, but then it's feared, and people want to get rid of it. People want to conserve it. So he really gets into all sides of the argument. It's fascinating.
And what does he say about where we are now in that whole, it's evil and going to kill us and we need to kill it first versus it's part of the ecosystem and we need to preserve it?
Well, the good news is I think people more and more and more are recognizing, not just herpetologists, but just the average person are recognizing that we need to preserve these animals. You know, they were here before us. They should be here after us. I'm sorry. Let me to keep turning the conversation to death.
That's okay. That's okay.
But
you like dead things. We'll
know,
talk about that more
it's true.
Later.
It's yeah. true. But, yeah, that we're kind of understanding we have to figure out a way to live with all these animals and all these American ecosystems rather than just get rid of them. And so he does get into conservation methods and ways we're protecting them.
Now, the subtitle of that book is The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. So does that mean that the timber rattlesnake has got some bad news right now?
Well, I mean, their population is dwindling, and while we should conserve them, there are still people who do not take kindly to them when they see them. And so it's a hopeful book, I have to say. But, you know, we have to get through kind of a low period before we can get back on the upswing.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We're here in our Milwaukee studios talking about great science reads, especially for the summer. Let's go to a caller now at 800-486-8655. We'll try bringing on Caleb in Woodstock, Illinois. Caleb, hi, you're on the air. No, we'll keep noodling around. Caleb, hi, are you there?
Hello, yeah.
Yep, go ahead, Caleb.
Hi, yeah, I was calling in to suggest a book by author, inventor, futurist, and current director of engineering at Google called a man named Raymond Kurzweil. He wrote a book a couple years back called How to Create a Mind, and it's just kind of a really fascinating read. He goes over in details kind of our current understandings of the brain and how he's been able to use a lot of our current understandings to develop algorithms and stuff, such as speech recognition software and all kinds of stuff like that. So it kind of lets the readers understand what we all have on top of our heads a little better and more in depth, and also gives a kind of a broader hope for the future of brain development.
Caleb, thanks a lot for that call. I've not read anything by Ray Kurzweil, Gemma, but I understand it's pretty mind-blowing stuff a lot of the time. It's cutting-edge brain research, the future of machine intelligence, that kind of thing. Any other good research or reading out there along those lines lately?
Well, you know, there is a book, I think it just came out right about now. It's by Sean Carroll. It's called The Big Picture, and it's on the origins of life, the meaning, a universe itself. It's kind of a mouthful to say, but I would say it's not really a lighter read. It's a read where you really have to be in a situation where you can sink your teeth into it. But he does get into a lot of the big picture issues, a lot of the way physics plays out in our lives that you might not think about as we're driving down the road. So it's a good read, though. I'd recommend it for sure.
And Gemma, any thoughts on Ray Kurzweil? I think, isn't he someone who's pretty into anti-aging as well?
You know, I think so, but I'm not an expert on him, so I haven't read anything by him.
Good.
Sorry.
To get a recommendation there from Caleb. And by the way, you can keep the calls coming. 800-486-8655. What is your favorite science read? What about a good beachy summer science read? Let us know at 800-486-8655. And Gemma, you also you profile a book talking about honeybees and sort of the language of the ways that the bees communicate with each other physically, almost like a dance.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing about this research is it goes way back to the 30s and 40s. A researcher by the name of Carl von Frisch actually noticed that bees communicate through basically, you know, hammer time for bees. And so he
with
was
the pants and everything?
Yes, absolutely, with the pants. And he really started to decode how bees communicate. And it's fascinating because a lot of times we think of communication as, you know, being able to speak, being able to do certain things. And other animals have it figured out. You know, they'll never be on the radio, obviously, because they dance, they don't talk. But still, really great read.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine now about science book recommendations for the summer.
And we're taking your calls, and you can join the conversation at 800-486-8655. Tell us about your favorite books about science. And you can also share magazines and blogs, too. That's 800-486-8655. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine about smart summer science reads.
And we're taking your recommendations too at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. What makes a good science read? Is there a science book you've read lately that you'd want to recommend? We'll even branch out a little if you've got some really sciencey science fiction for us. Call now at 800-486-8655. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Monica on the line in Pewaukee. Monica, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two recommendations. These are more science fiction, but they are very enjoyable and they keep your attention for sure. One of them is Zoo by James Patterson, and the other one is Ready Player One.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember the author.
I can almost remember the author of Ready Player One, but I can't. Do you remember, Rod?
I can't think
You've
of it either.
It.
I have, and it pushed. Thank you so much for that, Monica. Ready Player One pressed all my nerd buttons. It's set in the future, but basically all the pop culture is derived from my childhood and teenage years, from, you know, comic books to the movies to Dungeons and Dragons. Science fiction, Gemma, are there science fiction reads you might recommend for the summer? I don't know. You're a science writer. I assume you're a science fiction person. Am I wrong?
Well, I have a dirty little secret, and I know no one else is listening now, right?
Right. It's
okay.
Just us.
Okay. So I do so much reading at work that, when I'm not at work for enjoyment, I pretty much watch police procedurals on ION TV. Law and Order, Criminal Minds, yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's hard taking your work home with you.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. Well, we're not expressly science people on Central Time. We are when we talk to you, but I like to go science fiction because it's the opposite of what we're doing during the day. So I appreciate those recommendations, Monica. Zoo and Ready Player One, which I think is going to be a movie.
I think so, too. Yeah, and that's a bit of a thriller. And then you've got a real-life thriller, Gemma, getting back to your list, one called The Winter Fortress, and this is about sabotaging Hitler's atomic bomb project.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. And, you know, Neil Bascom, the author, has done a lot of World War II books, and he's really very well researched. But he got access, for the first time ever, I believe, to the journals of some of the scientists who were trying to build Hitler's bomb. And so he really brings in their perspectives. If you can imagine, you're the scientist, and, you know, Der Fuhrer says, build me a bomb. You're like, oh, great. So that's a terrific. And also in terms of thrillers, I really strongly recommend The Dragon Behind the Glass. It's by Emily Voigt, and it opens with this absolutely spectacular, tragic, but just gripping murder scene. And it's nonfiction, and it's all about this the most expensive tropical fish that people are just going bananas over collecting for their aquariums. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's
for
really
a fish.
For a fish that's just a couple feet long, and it just, you know, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't, like, shoot laser beams out of its eyes or anything. It's a fish, and it's associated with good luck in some Asian cultures. And there are these bidding wars and this whole, like, underground trade and organized crime built around this fish.
Wow.
And it's just incredibly written. Very
sounds
exciting.
Sort of like The Orchid Thief for fish.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Inside the tropical world, the underground world of rare fish collectors.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. Well, another one that you really liked, Gemma, was called Choice or Chance: Understanding Your Locus of Control and Why It Matters. Tell us about that one.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I don't know about you, but I have a lot of friends on Facebook who will say things like, oh, the guy ahead of me in line cut me off. That's my sign to buy a lottery ticket or, you know, whatever. Just like these very weird associations. And Stephen Nowicki, the author, really gets into, okay, what is actually controllable in your life? What is just coincidence? How can you recognize the two? What does it mean when your brain interprets everything as, oh, this means that I must do that, or this means that this is going to happen? And just really gets into kind of the neuroscience of superstition and believing, seeing connections that maybe aren't quite there. So I really like it. It's really interesting.
Is this one of those that kind of changes the way you think in your daily life, having read this? Do you start to second guess yourself?
You know, now that you've said that, I really feel like it's a sign.
Right. Me saying that's a sign that...
Well, I think what you get out of the book depends on both how superstitious you are to begin with and also how open you are to admitting your superstition. I think that depends. But he lays it out in a very accessible, easy to understand kind of way.
And we're taking your calls right now for your favorite science reads. What's a great one that you read? Maybe you're looking for a recommendation from Gemma. Well, you can reach us right now. Give us a call at 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. And Gemma, another one that rung your bell a little bit was about paper.
Yeah. You know, Mark Kurlansky wrote a great book called COD, and he takes these kind of like big things and topics that really stretch over history and geography, and he really kind of lays them out in terms of how that particular invention or particular ingredient or object impacted world history and how we can trace world history through this one thing. And in this case, he's looking at paper all the way from, you know, the very first scratchings on pieces of papyrus all the way up till now. And, you know, a lot of people say this is kind of the death of paper with the increasingly digitization of our world. But he makes a good case for why we maybe don't want to get rid of paper.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about great science reads. And, of course, a lot of science writing is in blog form these days, Gemma. You have a new one, and we've known this about you. You are obsessed one way or another with dead things, early human history, paleontology, things like that. What are you covering on your dead things blog?
Well, I wouldn't say obsessed, really. I mean,
I don't like to argue with our guests, but I'd say obsessed.
Okay. I am a bit Wednesday Addams. I will admit that. But I started this blog, Dead Things, at discovermagazine.com. And really, you know, we know a lot of our readers are very interested in fossils, very interested in paleoanthropology and paleontology. And we just thought, let's have a blog that can really kind of meet their needs. So it's a little bit of everything. Sometimes I'll interview authors like Jules Howard, who did the great book Death on Earth. Sometimes I'll talk about the latest news. We had a couple of really cool horned dinosaurs that were just formally described for the first time earlier this week. Sometimes, you know, if a controversy comes up about what is this fossil? Hey, is it Neanderthal? Is it human? How do we know? You know, I'll look at that. So it's just a little bit of everything and trying to just, you know, give our readers something to look forward to in terms of dead things.
Well, let's take a caller now. We've got Elise on the line in Wauwatosa. Elise, hi.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
So my recommendation is How Dogs Love Us, subtitle, Neuroscientist and His Adopted Dog Decode the Canine Brain. I just finished it on vacation. And I laughed, I cried, it was so good, and it's just really for all the dog lovers out there.
What did you learn about how dogs love us?
So, basically, I guess I just kind of learned that, you know, my dog is, well, we're part of the same pack, and this part of the brain lights up when she sees me, the same part that lights up the reward system.
Nice. Elise, thank you so much for sharing that. Lots of people love dogs, feel the same way you do, Elise. And that one was called How Dogs Love Us.
Gemma, you're nodding here.
Yeah, I read that book. And I have to admit that the entire book, I couldn't get over one fact. That they got their dogs, the researchers got their dogs to lay down motionless in the MRI machine to check their brains. And I'm like, how do you do that? Like, how much peanut butter do you give them to make them just lie still? My dogs do not
do
that.
That's great.
Time for one more quick call. Nina in Trempolo. Nina, hi.
Hi. I was listening and I heard you guys talking about books and favorite books, and I just wanted to share one of my old favorites.
What is it?
Thomas Lewis's Lives of a Cell.
Oh, yeah. It's a series of essays, I think. Lewis Thomas, that's one I've actually read, and pretty good. I assume there's more up-to-the-date biology, because that book's been around a while, Gemma. You know, we're actually a little short on time. How big is your stack of two reads right now, Gemma?
It's not a stack. It's actually...
A room?
It's a wall
storage
in my room.
Facility?
Just, yeah. It's a pile and a pile and a pile and a pile.
And for your blog, Dead Things, which is new, what can we expect to see there in the near future?
Well, actually, fingers crossed, I am planning an upcoming trip soon to the Republic of Georgia, which, in addition to being the cradle of wine, it's where they started making wine, it's also where they found the oldest hominids outside of Africa. And I'm hoping to check those out and report back.
Nice. Well, we'll look forward to that.
Gemma, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Gemma Tarlak here in our Milwaukee WPR studio. Gemma Tarlak is senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joined us to talk about her suggestions for smart summer reads. Still time for you to share your favorite science reads. And we're talking books, magazines, or put up a link to your favorite science blog. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And don't worry, Gemma will be back with us. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology.